Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have news of an arrest made for the murder of a mother of three who was shot while driving on Highway 94 in Spring Valley. County supervisors have approved asking the state of California to suspend the gas tax amid rising prices at the pump, among other actions that the county wants the state to take to provide relief for consumers. A bipartisan group of San Diego legislators in Sacramento have introduced legislation that aims to reduce the record high number of deaths in San Diego County jails after a state auditor found conditions so dangerous that legislative action is needed. And on a related note, our newsmaker interview today is with Dave Myers. He's a candidate running for sheriff, and he says we need a new sheriff in town. He'll be sharing his ideas to reduce the shocking number of deaths at county jails, as well as addressing issues ranging from reducing crime rates to programs to help prevent young people from committing crimes in the first place. Then on Destination East County, hear about some fun and festive events coming up across our East County region, including Daffodil Days in Julian, Classic Car Nights in El Cajon, Vintage Alpine, A Taste of Julian, and Campo Days. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Tidwell with a Crime Beat report. The California Highway Patrol has announced an arrest in the deadly shooting of a motorist on Highway 94 in Spring Valley. 47-year-old Thomas Evans III of La Mesa is charged with the murder of Sandralina Williams. Williams, a 27-year-old resident of National City, was a mother of three young children. She was driving her white SUV on March 5th near the Kenwood Drive exit on State Route 94 when Evans is accused of opening fire from another vehicle. Williams was kept on life support for several days after the shooting, and her organs were donated to save the lives of others, her aunt told NBC San Diego. The CHP, in collaboration with the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, executed a search warrant March 19th at Evans' home in La Mesa, where investigators found a weapon they believe was used in the murder and took Evans into custody. CHP Chief Scott Parker says the CHP Border Division's Special Investigations Unit has been working around the clock to find the person responsible for this senseless crime. He adds, "We know the arrest will not bring Miss Williams back, but we hope that the arrest of the man suspected in her murder will give her family some closure. The CHP is dedicated to ensuring those who commit crimes of violence on our highways will be caught and brought to justice. Anyone with information on this crime is asked to call the CHP Investigative Service Unit at 858-650-3620.
San Diego County supervisors voted unanimously on March 15th to approve asking the governor and legislature to suspend the gas tax for 1 year. The action was proposed in a letter to the board by East County Supervisors Jim Desmond and Joel Anderson. The supervisors also agreed to support a proposed state-funded gas tax rebate and back efforts to assure that oil companies lower gas prices by the same amount as any gas tax reduction, so that consumers will receive the full benefits. In Sacramento, both parties agree that consumers need relief from rising gas prices fueled largely by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but the parties have differed on how best to provide help to motorists. Republicans have advocated for a suspension of the state gas tax, but Governor Gavin Newsom and Democratic leaders are pushing for a direct rebate to vehicle owners in California. Supervisor Anderson thanked his colleagues for their support, adding, "These outrageous gas prices are not fair to the thousands of residents in my district who have no other options but to use their vehicles daily." Supervisor Desmond says he's thrilled the county has become the first in the state to push for the suspension of the gas tax. He says the action sends a strong message to leaders in Sacramento, adding, "This money belongs to the taxpayers, and we should do all we can to put it back in their pockets." Currently, there is a $45 billion surplus in the state budget. Supervisor Anderson says that according to the state's legislative analyst office, using 15% of this surplus could lower gas prices across the state by 51 cents per gallon and still fund all of the road infrastructure projects that the money is slated for. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A bipartisan group of San Diego state legislators has introduced AB 2345, the Saving Lives in Custody Act. The bill follows a scathing state auditor's report, which found conditions in San Diego County jails to be so dangerous that the auditor urged legislative intervention. San Diego has the highest number of jail deaths of any major county in California, 185 from 2006 to 2020, the period the auditor examined. In 2021, another 18 men and women lost their lives in custody, with 5 deaths so far this year, bringing the total to 208 jail deaths since 2006. The bill's author, Assemblymember Akila Weber, held a press conference on March 18th. Local co-authors include Senators Tony Atkins and Ben Huso, as well as Assemblymembers Chris Ward, Brian Mainsheen, and Tasha Borner Horvath. Assemblymember Weber, a medical doctor, posted on Facebook, "We believe a jail sentence should not be a death sentence, and are doing something about it." The bill is awaiting a hearing date in the Assembly Public Safety Committee. Also present at the press conference was A.C. Mills, whose son, Kevin Mills, died in a San Diego County jail in 2020. Mills says sheriff's employees knew about his son's mental and medical health issues, but did not get him the help that he needed. The bill, if approved, would add a licensed healthcare provider and a licensed mental health provider to the Board of State and Community Corrections. The board would be required to develop and adopt regulations for standards of care for inmates with mental health issues, including training requirements for staff at correctional facilities and mental health screening. It would also require safety checks of at-risk inmates after the state audit found that the sheriff's department frequently failed to conduct safety checks. Former Sheriff Bill Gore retired on February 3rd, the same day that state auditors released their report to the public. Gore questioned the audit's methodology. Acting Sheriff Kelly Martinez has said that she's committed to making changes to protect inmates, yet the most recent 2 deaths occurred on her watch. Lieutenant Amber Baggs told the San Diego Union-Tribune that the department's officials are reviewing the legislation and have already taken some steps to make jails safer, including improving safety checks, adopting drug treatment programs, speeding up review of critical incidents, and having guards wear body-worn cameras. The high number of jail deaths here has not only caused grief to family members, but has also resulted in taxpayers shelling out millions of dollars to pay legal settlements or court-ordered awards as a result of lawsuits filed against the county. Lieutenant Joel Stranger provided information on the 2 most recent deaths. 49-year-old Lonnie Rupard of National City was found unresponsive in his cell at San Diego Central Jail on March 17th. Despite life-saving efforts by deputies, medical personnel, and paramedics, Rupard was pronounced dead soon after at a local hospital. An autopsy found no signs of trauma or illegal substances. His cause of death remains pending further evaluation. He had been arrested on December 19th on a parole violation after previously serving time following an assault conviction. 22-year-old William Shuck of Orange County was found unresponsive in his cell in the Central Jail on March 16th. Despite life-saving efforts, he was pronounced dead at the facility. He had been arrested March 10th after a traffic accident on charges of driving under the influence, possessing a controlled substance, and illegal weapons possession. He had been treated and released from a hospital after the accident and declined further tests, according to Lieutenant Stranger. Shuck was alone in his cell when found unconscious, with no obvious signs of trauma or foul play. An autopsy found cocaine in his system, but the cause of his death is pending additional lab tests and evaluation. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is Dave Myers, a retired sheriff's commander who is now running for sheriff after the retirement of longtime sheriff Bill Gore. Dave Myers says it's time for a new sheriff in town to change the culture of law enforcement to one that respects everyone while assuring safe communities and rebuilding trust between residents and law enforcement. He has served in law enforcement for over 35 years. He's won awards for exceptional service and life-saving, and he's served in various nonprofits and community groups, including organizations helping at-risk youths, and led efforts to form the Sheriff's Youth Advisory Group. So, Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our region and the nation have seen racial justice protests that focused on law enforcement treatment of minorities, from the use of force to racial profiling and traffic stops and so forth. Tell us how you would go about restoring trust between law enforcement and communities of color, as well as other marginalized communities.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point about restoring trust in communities. Right now, unfortunately, law enforcement, not only here locally, but across the nation, have been seen as occupiers of neighborhoods and not community members, not the peace officers that need to come in and help control crime and prevent crimes and be actual members of communities. And I think recent racial profiling studies, Center for Policing Equity published information that does send up and indicate that there is racial profiling in policing. And, you know, I think one of the priorities is to get into the communities, to embed law enforcement leadership into the communities and talk about these issues. But I think more importantly is listen to community members and also have meaningful and robust independent community oversight group. It's also, I think, critical to restore community trust, for law enforcement leadership to be very supportive of independent community oversight.
Let's talk about crime. Obviously, a lot of people are concerned about that locally and nationally. You've said that you want to address the increase in violent crime. Can you tell us what steps you would take to reduce violent crime and protect public safety?
We are seeing a double-digit increase in violent crimes. And, you know, I have a proven track record in my over three decades in law enforcement of reducing violent crimes. And law enforcement must partner with community-based organizations, anti-violence groups that are embedded in communities to address these issues. This is not strictly a law enforcement issue. Law enforcement needs to respond to these incidents of increases in violent crimes, but law enforcement must take a very active role and partner with community-based organizations, anti-gun violence programs, youth alternative programs to gang involvement. And that's where I've seen success in reducing the issues of violent crimes.
Very good. I wonder, too, if you could comment on what some see as a revolving door for sort of career criminals, which is a little different than the young person who's first getting in trouble. I'll give you an example of that. We just had a guy arrested in El Cajon this week for attacking an El Cajon police officer with a baseball bat, screaming, "I want to kill you." There's a video of this. And this guy, it turns out, had three times been arrested before for violently assaulting police officers, convicted in two of those. And yet he was released with no jail time other than whatever time he'd served while he was awaiting trial. He got drug sentencing, was right back out, or rehab, was right back out with new drug offenses, you know, within a month. But the violence in particular is concerning. Do you think that there are any reforms needed in, you know, from a sentencing standpoint? Or, I mean, how would you handle somebody like that who has physically assaulted officers multiple times and been convicted of it?
Yeah, the system failed. The system failed the police officer who responded and who was assaulted with the baseball bat. The system has failed the community where this individual continues to prey on businesses and other folks. And so,
yeah, he was a shoplifter or accused of shoplifting, we should mention. That was what they were called out for.
Right, exactly. And so You know, in not only do we need to have catches within the system, mental health treatment within the county jail system and so on and so forth, but I also am an advocate for, again, working with community-based organizations to where to reduce the recidivism rate is to have the ability to work within the community once these individuals are released to where you monitor, do they have housing? Do they have wraparound medical services? Do they have access to job training? Do they need to continue in whatever is at some of the core issues of these individuals that are placed back in the community, working with probation? And the Sheriff's Department, I think, plays a major role in, let's say, at the tip of that spear, organizing these other community-based organizations to ensure success once they're released back into the community so we can reduce the 60 to 70% recidivism rate that we're seeing today.
Okay. Let's talk about accountability now of officers themselves. It's great to have accountability for people that assault officers, but we also want accountability, presumably, for officers that have done wrongdoing themselves. You have said that the prior sheriff covered up deputy misconduct. And in fact, it's worth noting, Dave, that you were the first to raise questions about Captain Marco Garmo, who was the Rancho San Diego sheriff's captain. And ultimately, he wound up, you noted he was buying an awful lot of guns and questioned that. Nothing was done. And a few years later, he was ultimately arrested for gun trafficking and tipping off marijuana dispensaries owned by, I guess, a relative of his, so they'd be prepared for raids and things. What steps specifically would you take if you're elected sheriff to hold officers accountable when they engage in misconduct or, in Garmo's case, criminal actions?
You know, historically, law enforcement, when one of their own does wrong, they circle the wagons and they cut off communication. They don't tell the public what happened. They don't disclose in a very transparent manner. And we've never had any really robust community oversight to expose. I truly believe that anybody in law enforcement who violates the public trust should be held at the same standard as somebody who was not in law enforcement that is selling guns illegally, who is protecting illegal cannabis dispensaries. Deputy Richard Fisher sexually assaulted over 20 women while on duty. And you cannot sit here and tell me that his beat partners, that his supervisors didn't question where he was for certain periods of time, or that somebody had called in and said he inappropriately touched me. We must, as law enforcement leaders, admit to the shortcomings of individuals in our field and immediately deal with the issue, separate them from service if that means termination, if that means incarceration in jail, and treat them like anybody else who violates the public trust.
Let's talk about the situation in the jails. You have a sign on your wall there. I had 165 people who've died in county jails since 2009. It looks like it's gone up since then. Is it now 185?
So on February 3rd, the Joint Legislative Audit state auditors released a report on jail deaths starting in 2006. And since 2006 to 2020, there were 185. I have crossed out the five because there has since been two more jail deaths in the last month.
Okay. Yeah. My data was from 2009, not 2006. Yeah, so that's shocking. And we should note, this is the highest jail death rate of any major county in California. And unfortunately, our region also has by far the highest number of jail suicides. I believe it's at least 30. Dave, what is the answer in your view? What steps would you take to reduce the number of deaths of people in custody? And we should note that it's bad enough that the legislative auditor has recommended legislative action. I know the supervisors are looking at what they can do, but you know, you'd be the top guy as sheriff, the jails would be on your watch. What would you do?
Yeah, this February 3rd report is not the first. Right. It's actually one of the latest out of four reports that were conducted over a period of about 4 or 5 years, because 4 years ago I was talking about the increase in jail deaths.
Right, it's long before COVID, which obviously only made it worse. But
and just now, the current acting sheriff, Kelly Martinez, wants to do something about and address the jail deaths. You know, to me, that's like the arsonist who set the fire and then is praised for putting it out. This issue of jail deaths has been going on for years and it's gone unaddressed. I do praise the current majority on the Board of Supervisors for accepting this latest report, the Joint Audit Report, and putting steps forward to change legislation to work with the County Law Enforcement Review Board to update independence in their review of jail deaths. Because if you remember, back in 2014, 2015, I stood before the County Law Enforcement Review Board when they dismissed, without investigating, 22 jail death cases, and asking them at least look at a pattern and practice of maybe a policy that is leading to this. And they didn't even do that. They just dismissed the jail death cases without even looking at it.
And there we should know, I just want to interject that Kelly Martinez, whom you mentioned, is one of the candidates in the race for sheriff. And in fact, she's the one that Sheriff Gore has endorsed. So for what that's worth, people may want to be aware of that. Go ahead.
Correct. Yeah. And she has been in charge during that entire time and has been well aware of all these previous reports and has done nothing to change the pattern and practice of jail deaths. We have a plan starting to where, who are we booking in the jail and why are we booking them in the jail? If it's a person with underlying mental health or drug treatment issues, it's nonviolent misdemeanors. Instead of spending $100,000 a year to house somebody in county jail, let's reinvent or reimagine policing by spending $20,000 to $30,000 a year on drug treatment beds in the community with professionals that know how to treat individuals with underlying mental health issues, underlying drug dependency issues. That doesn't mean these individuals are not going to be held accountable for the original reason they were arrested. We have 3 years and a day to file criminal charges, but let's treat the underlying issues that are bringing them into jails and not just allow overcrowding, which is what's happening in the county jail system right now, because the sheriff wants to open up a new jail. All right, that shouldn't be the public's goal. And then if they are in jail, let's provide just the basic medical care, mental health care, long-term drug treatment care. Let's embed mental health professionals at the onset of individuals being booked into jail to get as the professionals to interview these folks to see placement. And we have to separate out medical personnel and jail security professional. The deputies have to work together within a facility. What we are experiencing now is deputy sheriffs who are non-medical trained telling medical staff where to place individuals, and that is simply not working. The classification system in the jails is broken.
Very good point. You've also been somewhat outspoken on body-worn cameras for deputies, including jails. Tell us your views on that.
So outspoken, if you mean by very much in favor of it, absolutely. So 6 years ago, I was charged with creating the body-worn camera program for the Sheriff's Department. At the time, I presented to Sheriff's leadership that we should definitely implement a body-worn camera program, that it should definitely be test piloted in the jails, in the field, and for deputies that work within the court system, not necessarily in a courtroom, but deputies that serve warrants and also serve eviction papers.
Yeah, good point.
And so my recommendations were adopted just for the field and not for the jails or for the court system, deputy sheriffs.
How did it work out overall in your view?
I think it's working out. I think it could be much, much better when the original reason was to create more transparency in law enforcement and what happens, yet the state legislators recently had to create a law that mandated when footage would be released to the public under certain circumstances. And then what we see is law enforcement severely editing the video before they release it. Mm. I think the Sheriff's Department, and there's no reason the Sheriff's Department cannot have a website where full footage is downloaded onto on a daily basis.
Good point.
I want to ensure that we still protect victims, especially sexual assault and especially domestic violence victims. Mm-hmm. But there is no reason that we cannot download the video in its full extent and have it on a website that anybody can see at any time.
Good point. And how about the sheriff? You know, this is an aside, but for some reason, Sheriff Gore would never allow the release of photos of people who were arrested. And yet, you know, other law enforcement agencies routinely do that. Should that be a public record?
You know, I think it should be a public record. It is kind of a fine line, and there's a lot of discussion.
Right, because they haven't been convicted.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, individuals, just because you're arrested doesn't mean that you've been convicted of anything.
True.
Yet.
On the other hand, other people might see it and go, oh, that was the person that I had on my, you know, my doorbell cam breaking into my house last week or something. So, it can go two ways. It can, I suppose, falsely tar somebody who maybe is later found not guilty, and at the same time, it could arguably help solve other crimes, perhaps.
Absolutely. But I do agree that it is a public record.
Okay. Let's talk about another kind of public record. This one is really personal to me. Scanners. There is a new state law that requires that, I think rightly so, that private information, such as, say, the ID of a sexual assault victim or something, should not go out over scanner traffic. But what some law enforcement agencies have done is they've gone overboard and they've taken everything off scanner traffic. So here in San Diego, the San Diego Police Department figured out a good solution. They created a secure channel for only privacy information. And the rest of it, you can still listen to. Anybody can tune in and listen on the scanner, the public, the press. The sheriff did exactly the opposite. They've taken everything onto a secure channel. So we can no longer, as media, I cannot listen anymore. We run a wildfire and emergency alert service. I can no longer tell people, oh, there's a high-speed pursuit on the freeway at 100 miles an hour, or, oh, there's an active shooter, you know, in a park or a school or whatever else might be going on, unless we happen to hear about it from a concerned citizen. And I think that that puts the public in danger. Would you commit? I want to hear your views on it. And I'm asking every candidate this, will they commit 100% to put that information back on public scanners, with the exception of those things that the state requires must remain private?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right about the communication. I worked for over three decades in the law enforcement agency and used the radio traffic, and they currently have encrypted radio channels for operations that are taking place in the field where we don't
there's a SWAT team and they don't want everyone to know how they're sneaking up on the suspect, you know, who's holding a hostage. They already put that on secure. Yes. So they have a way to do it. They're just choosing not to.
Yeah. So it's, you know, once again, it's a department, sheriff's department leadership that does not want to be transparent nor share all the information with the general public, which I think they have a right.
Yeah.
Martinez
could change that in a heartbeat if she wanted to, but unfortunately she hasn't.
So. Yeah. So as sheriff, absolutely. All the encrypted information based on state law should be encrypted. Everything else, there's absolutely no reason to encrypt it and to hide it from the public. And then we get back to the transparency and the issues of trust within law enforcement when they're, in my opinion, they're hiding information.
Homelessness. I think if you ask anybody in San Diego County, they would rank homelessness as one of the biggest problems in our area. Under the prior sheriff, we've seen everything from sweeps of homeless camps, and then, you know, courts made it more difficult to do that. And more recently, some more humane approaches going on around the county with, you know, teams of non-law enforcement people going out to try to help get help for those who need it. And yet homeless camps on the street continue to rise. I just got a response back from the county that I think most people would think was kind of inadequate. There's a homeless camp right on Magnolia, just a few feet over the city line in El Cajon. It's county property. I've been told these are sort of, I hate to use the term hardcore homeless, but the ones who've been offered help won't take it. They've threatened people, supposedly, some of the aid workers. They just had an overdose out there a couple of nights ago, according to the city manager. And yet the county's attitude is, well, we go out every now and then and kind of, you know, make sure things are clean and tidy and offer help to those that'll take it. But there's nothing being done to address the public concern about, you know, risks to the public of people are afraid to walk by it. So I guess it's a very complex thing. I mean, what would your approach be and how might it differ from people who really need help, but just down on their luck, maybe they need temporary housing or job training, those who have drug addiction or mental health issues, and then those who simply won't get help and yet, you know, might be sort of the more dangerous, you know, element within the community out there. How it's a complicated problem, but how as sheriff would you do your part to get help for those who really need it and get them off the streets and into a safer place, as well as protecting the public from whatever threats there might be to them?
Yeah, no, all very good points. And the homeless issue for law enforcement has been thrust upon them.
Right.
It's very much a community-based issue where our local elected officials have not allocated appropriate resources to deal with those individuals that do want help, that do need housing, that do need wraparound services, job training, stress reduction, education, access to proper medical care. And so I think law enforcement should and must play a role with those individuals who take advantage of our communities and threaten others, damage property. Law enforcement plays a role there. But in my experience, that's a very, very minor role, and it's a very small percentage of individuals, very small percentage.
Yeah, it's interesting that in the city of El Cajon, you don't see this stuff, and they've managed to get many hundreds of people into various programs and shelters, and you go, you know, 3 feet over the border or whatever it is into the county, which has no, still has no shelters. They keep saying they're going to build some. They're making some progress toward it. But if the city of El Cajon can do better than this, why can't the county?
You know, and I think, and you and I know this, that the county has just seen a change in leadership at the board, and we're starting to see some of those changes to where the previous board had no interest in, if you will, social services and providing help as a government to underserved
individuals. Well, we should give some kudos here. Even some of the conservatives that are on the board now are compassionate on this issue and have actually led the effort. I know Joel Anderson even led the effort to say, let's do some homeless shelters and get some help for those that are willing to accept it, whereas Diane Jacob would not do that. And of course, the progressives, you know, on the board are all for getting help for those that need it. But it takes time. And in the meantime, it's still kind of a sheriff dilemma of how do you deal with this?
Yeah. And so, you know, and the sheriff also needs to take ownership of, historically, the sheriff has allowed outside agencies, outside police agencies, to use the jail system for these individuals when laws are created within these municipalities to book people into jail on a very temporary basis. They don't have bail money, so they have to stay in custody for periods of time. And COVID extended that. And I call that displacement, and that solves no problems. That solves no issues for any community long-term, and it just exacerbates the problem. And so, you know, the sheriff created a homeless outreach team of five or six deputy sheriffs for a county of 4,200 square miles. That is an absolute joke.
Yeah.
That tells me that there is no real buy-in to what the issues are. I think if the sheriff created an internal unit where the sheriff's department had, with in coordination, once again, with these mobile crisis response teams that are being created, and I don't think an armed response is necessary to go out and help educate individuals on resources to get them off the streets.
Correct. Yeah.
There are incidents in which armed, fully sworn deputy sheriffs need to respond because true criminal activity is occurring.
But right, like the guy with the baseball bat. I don't know if he's homeless or not, but that's an example. But you're right. Most of the time, it's just somebody who's down on their luck and somebody's complaining about, you know, trash on the sidewalk or something like that. That really is, there's probably a better approach to somebody who just needs help than putting them in jail.
Correct.
You know, you mentioned about not enough deputies, and it reminded me of another pet peeve of many people in East County, but that is when you get out in these rural areas. A few years ago, we did a records request on response times, and it was abysmally slow in places like, you know, Campo and Boulevard and Hacumba. Some of these people we're waiting an average of an hour for even the most violent things. You know, I see somebody being stabbed next door, and it would take an hour for a response. They often would call the Border Patrol first, even though it's not their jurisdiction, because they knew somebody would show up fast if they made that call. Would you commit to fight for more resources to get more deputies stationed out there so they're not at home and getting a call in the middle of the night when something violent? I realize, you know, they can't maybe be there for every little thing, but certainly for violent crimes, shouldn't we be able to do better for people in every part of the county?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I used to be a lieutenant in the backcountry in the rural division. And I did fight for more deputy sheriffs in the rural division, even to the point where I submitted a federal grant so that I can at least get deputy sheriffs on overtime working in the rural area, especially along the international border. We need to, as sheriff, advocate for more resources in our rural communities because things go on after dark out there. When our rural deputies who are home and who are asleep, not very many people know that we don't have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week coverage in the backcountry. Mm-hmm. And I know that we can do better. And I know with more deputy sheriffs that we can provide the coverage and dramatically reduce the response times.
Okay, so it sounds like you might be a stronger advocate before the supervisors to get funding for those rural deputies.
Yes.
Let's talk about young people. Dave, you have a lot of experience working with young people to keep them out of trouble, as we've previously mentioned. What more would you do if you're sheriff to help, to help prevent them from going down the school to prison pipeline, so to speak?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And law enforcement has a lot of discretion in dealing with youth and dealing with those under the age of 18 who might get criminal justice involvement. And I think right now the path has been juvenile justice involvement first and then try and figure out other paths for them afterwards. What I want to do is I want to embed the restorative justice process at the beginning of that, at the front end of the juvenile justice involvement process, at least within the sheriff's department.
So for people who don't know what restorative justice means, can you explain that?
Yeah. So it's essentially community-based. If you've ever heard the saying, it takes a village. So, and I'll give you an example of one I specifically was involved in. A young kid, a freshman at high school, was involved in stealing a loaf of bread from a local 7-Eleven in Lakeside. I get called as a deputy sheriff. Usually the protocol is, okay, we arrest you, we take you to juvenile hall. But then I got to talking with the kid, why aren't you in school? You've been truant. Okay, let's go home, figure out what's going on there. The mother had underlying mental health issues, couldn't work. There were no beds in the house. There was a small brother that lived there.
Oh my gosh.
It was unkempt. There was no food in the refrigerator. So the kid was just trying to feed his family. The kid was trying to be the family. So I thought, okay, this is ridiculous. So I got a local church involved. I got local neighborhood watch group involved. I got the school involved. So we got food in the refrigerator. We got beds with clean sheets in the bedrooms. We got the mother a program to where she cleaned herself up. We got her a part-time job. Wow. The kid was in school every single day. The kid graduated high school and went on to college.
Wow.
And it was not just me. I mean, it was the community involvement. It was the restorative process. And the kid does not have a criminal record because we also got 7-Eleven involved.
So they don't. Yeah.
Yeah. So that they, you know, we could have a success story. And so
that's a great story. We need, I think, a lot more of that, Dave.
Right.
My opinion.
Right. And it was that's the restorative process. That's where everybody buys into how can we make our community better? And if we all pitch in, this is how we do it. There was no political affiliations. There was a conversation about how can we make this family successful.
Yeah, well, that's great. Let's talk about another problem that's a problem nationally, but also locally. And that is the rise of hate groups, extremist groups, specifically white supremacy groups. The Southern California or the Southern Poverty Law Center just did its latest report, which identified yet more hate groups in our area. And I will say that Dave, through the years, it seems like even when an attack is caught on video, nothing happens to those who were responsible. I can tell you that our media outlet has had reporters threatened and even assaulted by, you know, sort of racist white supremacist types out here. We've published videos of some of these folks assaulting young people of color who were doing nothing more than standing there with a sign, clearly showed the faces of the assailants, even when this was brought to the attention of law enforcement, when people let them know about it, nothing happened. They never reached out to us. They never, I should say La Mesa police did when it occurred in La Mesa, but in the sheriff's jurisdiction, it just seemed like nothing's happened. And yet they would go and arrest, you know,
you reach the officers,
young people of color who were, you know, 1 minute past curfew at these protests and do nothing about the people who were assaulting them. What will it take, Dave? I know this is an issue that concerns you, but how do you get the law enforcement officers in communities like Santee and Lakeside that seem to be sort of hotbeds for these groups to take this seriously? And while everybody has a right to protest and state their views, even if they offend people, there's something very different from, you know, wearing a sign or putting a mask on your face with some message versus actually beating people up in the streets. How would you address this problem, including the lack of responsiveness, frankly, by some of the law enforcement folks out there?
Yeah, you know, the FBI has identified white supremacy, white nationalism as the greatest domestic threat. And I've seen it. I've seen it here in San Diego County. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of years addressing it within the county sheriff's department and within the county of San Diego, not just some East County areas, but all parts of San Diego County.
Yeah, it's in North County and other areas. Yeah. I'm familiar with what happens here, but I've certainly read about pockets of it in many other
countries. I am absolutely committed to putting the same emphasis, the same staffing, probably even more, creating a special unit of detectives over and above those committed to Black and Brown gangs to addressing the white nationalists and white extremists. I've seen it here in San Diego. I attended some of those La Mesa events. I saw some of the Proud Boys that I don't like to mention their names because I don't want to highlight who they are, but they showed up at protests, Black Lives Matter protests, carrying large knives on their belts. And I pointed it out to La Mesa officers and they just kind of shrugged it off.
I know, we've got pictures of it.
They wouldn't let me carry a big stick on my sign, but they allowed these individuals into the protest area with these large knives on their belt. I do know that there are, within law enforcement in San Diego County, white supremacists and white extremists.
I wonder, do we need maybe more people of color on the force, particularly assigned to the places that have been hotbeds for this kind of a problem? As opposed
and,
to,
you know, I think we need to have a very, we need to have in law enforcement a very robust program to where we monitor our own. You know, the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, it's very well documented that lots of officers who were off duty and military that were off duty were there participating in an insurrection against our U.S. Capitol.
Do we know if any of those were local, especially from the sheriff department?
I have not heard of any that participated in the actual event itself, but I have heard that there are individuals that supported it. And you also, La Prensa recently published a Deputy Sheriff's Association survey that has 32 pages of comments from deputy sheriffs, and they're very supportive of the former Oath Keeper sheriff in Riverside County, Sheriff Bianco. And so there are sympathizers I know currently within the sheriff's department.
Let's talk about guns, another sort of hot button issue. Dave, you have taken a fairly moderate stance on this one. I know when you ran for sheriff in the past, you actually were endorsed by the San Diego Gun Owners Association for taking a moderate position on issues like concealed carry permits, saying that Sheriff Gore wasn't doing enough to, you know, allow the issuance of those. But you've also been outspoken on the need to crack down on things like ghost guns. So I guess I'm just going to leave this open-ended and ask you, what would you like our listeners and for on our website, our readers, to know about your views on where you would draw the balance between protecting Second Amendment rights versus reducing gun violence, which is, you know, at an alarming rate in our country?
Yeah, I myself have been the victim of gun violence, where I've been shot at by a security guard, and I've had a gun held to my head and the trigger pulled, but thankfully the bullet was bad and didn't go off.
Oh my gosh.
So I know about gun violence. I know about gun violence against our law enforcement in the fields. And there are too many people that have access to guns. The issue of ghost guns, there should be no gun that law enforcement cannot trace through a serial number that's on the streets.
And yeah, those are homemade guns that very often criminals use because they can't legally go buy one. So they're making their own now with parts off of the internet, for people that aren't familiar with the term.
Yeah, as sheriff, I am absolutely committed to enforcing the law when it comes to concealed carry permits issued by the sheriff. Mm-hmm. I think the policy that I put forward 4 years ago, I still stand by today. You know, the sheriff gets to do a complete and thorough background check on anybody that wants to carry a concealed carry weapon. Then you have to go to the sheriff's range and demonstrate proficiency in that firearm. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a win-win for the community. I think people need to, responsible gun owners need to ensure that their guns are safely locked up so they're not getting stolen, and access to those guns by individuals that should not have them. I am absolutely a supporter of the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, the Eighth Amendment, all of them.
All of them.
Very critical that we support that. But the fact that individuals that should not have access guns that do, I think law enforcement needs to step up its enforcement on the violence associated with gun violence.
Thank you for that. Tell us about who your major endorsements are. I see you've got some, you know, across the board, but who are some of the endorsements that you're most proud of in this race, Dave?
I'm actually absolutely proud of every single one of them. The one I'm most proud of is my mother. My mother, who has been out supporting me from day one and is very involved in it. You know, I am supported by Congress members Mike Levin and Sarah Jacobs. I'm supported by current La Mesa Council member Bill Baber and Mayor Arapostathis in La Mesa. And across the board.
Some cross-party line endorsements there, and at least with Mr. Baber and Councilman Baber, and
and across the county of San Diego, from Imperial Beach, National City, Chula Vista, up to Vista, Encinitas, Carlsbad, and so we have a very, very broad swath of endorsements. The San Diego County Democratic Party overwhelmingly supported me. Because they understand, and those who endorse me understand, that we need a change in law enforcement in the San Diego Sheriff's Department, one that does not include a conversation of defunding. I have never supported any conversations of defunding anybody, but I truly believe that law enforcement must reimagine policing. We must get a handle on the double-digit crime increases, and I have a proven track record of reducing crimes in neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think we all want someone to answer when we call 911, but it's a matter of using the money wisely, as you say, not defunding it, but making sure that it's used in the most appropriate ways and that everybody's accountable. Listeners, we are speaking with Dave Myers. He is a retired sheriff commander and one of the leading candidates in the race for San Diego County Sheriff, which is an open seat after the retirement of former Sheriff Bill Gore. The primary election is coming up, the first Tuesday in June, and if nobody gets more than 50%, as I understand it, there would be a runoff in November.
If you remember, unlike last time, this is the first time Measure D, which was passed by the voters in 2018, will be implemented. So regardless of if anybody gets 50% plus one, the top two must go to a general.
Okay, so you're hoping to be in that top two. Dave, I want to ask what you view as the biggest contrast between yourself and the other major candidates running that you'd like folks to know about, and what's your strategy to win the election, or at least make it for now into the top two in June?
Yeah, no, very good question. I have a proven track record of results. I have a proven track record of reducing violent crimes because I've implemented strategies that work. We must stop the jail deaths. I am not afraid to take on the status quo to change, to make things better, to be transparent, and to be accountable to the public. I will engage the communities all over the county of San Diego. We will address issues and we will listen to communities because it's what law enforcement is supposed to be. I want to restore the competency within the ranks of the Sheriff's Department at all ranks, at all levels, amongst all classifications. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Dave, for joining us. I want to ask if you have any parting thoughts and where people can find more information about your campaign or get involved.
So our campaign, you can find it on our website, www.davemyers4sheriff.com. Again, all one word, davemyers4sheriff.com. We're on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us, sign up to help out, and learn more about our campaign.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine show here on KNSJ. I want to take a moment to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to hear our show, where we report news that matters to people across our region. In an era of cuts to many major media outlets, shrinking local news coverage, and cries of fake news attacking journalists with courage to report the truth, it's important to recognize and support KNSJ Radio. KNSJ gives airtime for original reporting on issues that matter here in San Diego and East County, as well as national news that impacts people here at home. You can donate to help support real news, honest reporting, and inclusion of your community's views and voices at knsj.org. That website again is knsj.org.
The primary election is coming up in just 3 months, so it's time to make sure your voter registration is up to date. A lot of people moved during the pandemic, so you can update your records at registertovote.ca.gov. Ballots will be mailed to all registered voters in early May. Carol Moon Goldberg with the League of Women Voters says the biggest mistake people make is forgetting to sign the envelope.
Be sure to sign the envelope when the ballot is being returned. That has been traditionally the number one reason why a ballot has not been counted.
Legislative boundaries changed with redistricting, so you may find yourself in a different district with new candidates running. You'll find a trove of information on the Secretary of State's website or at the League of Women Voters site, which is votersedge.org. Moon Goldberg says the state takes multiple precautions to make sure the ballots are secure. Each ballot has a barcode, and the signature is matched with the one on file.
But the kind of paper, even the tint of the paper and a watermark is established by the Secretary of State's office. You can't go down to Kinko's FedEx and make a copy of one.
You can sign up for texts that track your ballot at wheresmyballot.sos.ca.gov. The primaries are open. Candidates from all parties will appear on everyone's ballot. And the top two will compete in the general election, regardless of party affiliation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week. This week's Destination East County includes a look ahead at some of the most iconic festivals and events coming up soon and throughout the springtime season. The Julian Daffodil Project was started by Sally Snipes in 1990 as a memorial to her father, Jack Snipes, and now there are 4 million bulbs planted in the Julian area. You can enjoy You Pick Daffodils on Saturdays and Sundays from March 19th all the way through May 1st during Daffodil Days at Julian Farm and Orchard. Daffodils are said to symbolize friendship, but also new beginnings. They are one of the first signs of spring and are known in Britain as Lent lilies associated with Easter. Find details at visitjulian.com. Cajon Classic Cruise Car Shows return in the heart of downtown El Cajon, where thousands of people converge to visit displays of classic vehicles each Wednesday night from 5 to 8 p.m. Opening night is April 13th, and the season runs through October 26th. Many attendees enjoy arriving early to dine at local restaurants, including some with outdoor seating. The events customarily also include a DJ with music to liven up the festivities. Find details at downtownelcajon.com. Julian's annual Taste of Julian celebrates the town's diverse culinary delights, proving there's much more here than the community's famed apples. The self-guided tour includes a variety of participating restaurants, bakeries, and tasting rooms for wine, beer, and cider on April 30th from 12:30 to 5 p.m. Early reservations are recommended since this event sells out. Find tickets and details at visitjulian.com. You're invited to experience the history and heritage of San Diego's East County during Campo Day. The event will take place this year on Saturday, April 30th at four separate locations all day long: the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, the Motor Transport Museum, Gaskell Brothers Stone Store Museum, and the Camp Lockett Event and Equestrian Facility. The event will bring life to the community's colorful past, which includes a historic railway, Wild West Shootout, Native Americans, pioneers, cowboy skills, buffalo soldiers, a cavalry camp, and living military history. Plus, there is also an evening dance. For more information, check out visitcampo.com. Vintage Alpine will offer savory taste from over 40 local wineries, restaurants, and breweries, all in the beautiful gardens of Summers Past Farms in Flynn Springs on May 1st from 1 to 4 p.m. Visitors can also enjoy live music and a silent auction. It's all for a good cause, benefiting the Kiwanis Club of Alpine Foundation, which supports services and programs for children in San Diego County. For tickets and a full list of vendors, visit vintagealpine.com. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County. You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show: Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jewell, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine Show here on KNSJ. I want to take a moment to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to hear our show, where we report news that matters to people across our region. In an era of cuts to many major media outlets, shrinking local news coverage, and cries of fake news attacking journalists with courage to report the truth, it's important to recognize and support KNSJ Radio. KNSJ gives airtime for original reporting on issues that matter here in San Diego and East County, as well as national news that impacts people here at home. You can donate to help support real news, honest reporting, and inclusion of your community's views and voices at knsj.org. That website again is knsj.org.